Can you hear me?
I can.
Hey, cool. Fucking hell.
Light
Technology. Isn't it fucking great?
warning here, but language disclaimer. Welcome to Raising Standards, an occasional rewatch podcast in which we take a fond look at HBO's Rome. I'm Matt Smith. I'm joined as always by Rhiannon Evans, and the voice that you heard at the top of the tape, that was James Purefoy, the acclaimed actor who played Mark Antony. Also joining us on the end of the same Zoom call is Lucius Verinus himself, Kevin McKidd.
We've had a nice dinner. You might find us a little more loquacious than usual. Probably a bit of a scoop.
Well, I'm on the small chair, James. You can't put me on the small
I put
chair.
you in the comfy chair. That's the comfy chair. That's like known as the comfy
No,
chair in
the
the world.
world more counting me in Verena's
No, it's
status.
not. It's not. You're right, Shorty.
I'd been trying to get in touch with both of them during the course of this podcast, but they are both very busy and in-demand actors. But in the wake of the passing of Ray Stevenson, they reached out personally and set this up. And on an evening when Kevin was in London, they reunited and joined us on this call to talk about Rome, and this interview is very much a tribute and love letter to the memory of Ray.
I think somehow we need to encompass the fact that, as Kevin mentioned, you are sitting on the throne as Mark Antony, and he's lower.
Exactly.
I don't feel like I am. I swear, the choice of seat was I'm going to give Kev
No, this is
the comfy chair.
James, this is as it should be.
This famous Eames chair is the comfiest
It's a
chair
very
apparently in
comfortable
the
chair.
world.
A disclaimer, this is regrettably, unfortunately, a Zoom call of dubious quality. But while the audio quality is terrible, the content is heartfelt, genuine, and very entertaining. I hope you persevere with it. Enjoy.
So how are you two going? I imagine this has been, your first catch up in quite a while.
Yeah, it has been. It has, but we've known each other a very long time. We've known each other for, I mean, crikey, 20 years, 25 years.
Over 20, yeah, 25 years, I'd say. We worked together the very first time on a film, a Rose Trichet film called Bedrooms and Hallways,
Yes.
which was probably 25 years ago. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah, it's a hidden gem of the queer scene. So they tell me.
And so when you saw each other that you were both going to be involved in Rome, it must have been like, quite a reunion for you then.
Yeah, I think, but we've remained friends. And I think there've been other projects that we could have done together, and we
That's right.
didn't. But we've remained friends, and genuinely, we all have friends who you just call up and you haven't spoken to for 5 years, and you just continue the
Yeah,
conversation.
you sort of pick up where you left off. I think I remember about, was it 2 years ago?
Yeah.
And I called you, one of us called each other out of the blue, and we literally had a 2.5 hour conversation together.
Yeah, I was on location in northern France shooting Marie Antoinette, and the phone rings, and it's him.
Yeah.
And it's one of those friendships. So it's very welcome, certainly in my life.
Yeah, I mean, mostly because you are highly trained actors, we just want you to talk. But I guess that I wanted to ask you, because we want to talk to you, but also to talk about Ray Stevenson. And I'm just wondering how you first met Ray.
I'm blaming. Well, what's your
I think
story?
I met him before you.
Well, I think we might be in competition over that. I'd like to hear your story.
So I did a show with Ray called Tide of Life. It was one of the Catherine Cookson's.
Oh, really?
Yes. I did that maybe 8 or 9 years before I did Rome.
No.
Catherine Cookson's are a kind of romantic feast of set in the north of England. And I was a kind of an adventurer who'd come back into a girl's life. And he was the local sort of stalwart northern boy. And obviously she would be the one, he would end up with her because, that's the way those things go, and not the scallywag who comes back.
Right.
And so Ray was on that. So I didn't have many scenes with Ray, but I had a few pints with him
Yeah.
in the hotel of an evening and knew that he was a scallywag.
Yeah. So that was 8 years before Rome. So I met Ray probably about a year before Rome through a friend of his. He went to drama school with a guy called Gilly Gilchrist, Scottish actor,
Yeah.
right? And I knew Gilly, and I was up in Glasgow drinking with Gilly and his girlfriend. And we got invited to a famous playwright in Scotland
Called
Peter MacDougall, who
yes,
wrote Down Among the Big Boys and all these other
yes.
things. Peter MacDougall was renowned for, he'd been to prison and he wrote all these like screenplays about tough guys and like gangsters in Glasgow. Gilly Gilchrist invited me and Ray Stevenson and Ruth Gemmell, his wife, to dinner to Peter McDougall's flat in Glasgow.
Oh, yeah. And you hadn't met him at this point?
I hadn't met Ray, and this was the night we met. Okay. We're all having this lovely dinner, and suddenly there was a knock on the door of Peter McDougall's flat, and this guy comes in who's obviously a local gangster in Glasgow with a plastic bag with something very heavy in it, clunks it down, and we're all like, what's that? Turns out it's a shotgun, and he's this local Glasgow gangster called Toe Elliot. And the reason he's called Toe Elliot is that apparently in Retribution, bitten some guy's toes off years before. Anyway, so we're all terrified, me and Ray Stevenson and Ruth Gemmell and Gilly Gilchrist in this flat, because this gangster suddenly admits with a shotgun.
And you're just actually, we're just having dinner. You're actors who sometimes play hard, but you're just a bunch of actor softies.
So we all sit there, we're terrified, and we eventually, Toe Elliot decides to leave. He intimidates us all for about an hour. He goes, you're all a bunch of soft actors, man. Who are you? And all this stuff.
Yes.
And we're all like shaking. And eventually, Toe Elliot leaves, and we all like, oh my God. And we celebrate the fact that we're all still alive.
We're still alive. Fantastic.
A few months later, Ray Stevenson and I have this audition for a show called Rome.
Yeah.
And they do a screen test of us both. And I am convinced that the fact that he and I had that night, we survived that night, was the thing that kind of
gave that spark to your relationship.
Marvellous. That's when I met Ray Stevenson.
That is brilliant and not what I was expecting.
Bringing up Ray, but I think it is... You know, I don't want to go too far down this conversation without obviously recognising the massive loss that we have with Ray. And I think about him every day. I got out his ring recently.
Did you?
The 13th. I forgot to wear it, bizarrely, today.
Yeah.
But I've been wearing it ever since. Such a lovely thing to have. So he gave us all, well, a bunch of us, the kind of core group, a solid gold ring with the letters 13 written on it, which was obviously the Legion he and Kev were part of, and I was commander of. He's an extraordinary man. I've said it before, I said it again. Every single part Ray plays is full to the brim with something that you want to watch. He's one of those actors you just go, not quite sure what's going to happen.
Slightly out of control, but always, you know, but always full of love and life, right?
Yeah, full. I mean, to the brim. He really was a larger-than-life character. I now know what people mean, because everything he did with his foot right flat down on the pedal.
True.
And maybe we've only got, we were talking about this earlier, maybe we've only got a certain amount of miles per hour in us.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, if you live your life with that, with your foot on the pedal quite as much as he did, maybe you just burn out young. Take your foot off the pedal, kids. You know, just relax and don't do it so much.
But, you know, he had so much love in him, didn't he?
Yeah.
He loved everyone he met. He would give everybody that he met a big bear hug.
Yeah.
You know, he had this vivacity for life that was...
infectious.
So infectious.
Yeah.
I mean, and he could be infuriating, too.
Let's not pretend.
Yeah.
You know, there are lots of things that drove you mad about Ray. It drove me mad about Ray. But in totale,
yes.
As they would say on the set, the actuality,
that's right, they would.
Much better than worse.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's all you want at the end of your life, isn't it? Better than worse.
That's right, yeah. The world's a better place that Ray was in it.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, totally.
We could tell that even from only meeting him over the internet, which I now regret that when we interviewed him, it had to be like this, because I'd have liked to have that bear hug. But we could tell that he had so much love for that show just through talking to him. And he was so willing to talk and, you know, wanted to come back and talk. It was lovely.
Yeah, I listened to his interview on your show. It was part of the reason we got in touch with you, because it was really infectious. And you know, despite the fact, you know, he was a middle-aged man when he was talking to you, he sometimes sounds like a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
He's that excited.
Yeah.
There's so much of a boy in him.
That's right.
That I loved, you know, that kind of infectious, fuck you if you don't like something sincere.
Yeah.
You know, I'm being sincere and I like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to live that moment, that way.
Yeah, I mean, that job for all of us, as you said tonight, Jimmy, you know, It was the salad days for all of us.
It's a salad days job. When people talk about, you know, what was your favourite job that you ever did? You know, that was, for me, you know, that 2-year period that we spent exploring those characters and that world, where the possibility of things was so great. You could talk to Bruno and talk to him about an idea, like something you'd found out about a character, and 2 episodes time, it would be there. I remember talking to him about the fact that I'd found out that Mark Antony, one of his things was to drive around Rome in a chariot pulled by 4 lions. And I said to Bruno, I said, hey, that'd be fucking awesome, wouldn't it? I mean, like, can we get lions? You think they're a tame lions? Can we get lions to do that? And he went, no, of course we can't get lions to do that. He said, but I'll figure out a way. And there's a scene, before I have a big scene with Octavian in the second season, there's a scene where I'm coming in talking to my bestiary about the lions, and the lions were knackered. The lions were really hopeless and mangy. And he said, but I've got giraffes. And Mark Antony goes, do I look like a fucking giraffe, man? So he'd find a way to put things in. So do you know that that's a very exciting atmosphere to work in, where you can find something out and it's referenced in some passing way that just builds and adds more dimensions to your character.
And I remember discussing that scene with Rhiannon going, this is what they're referring to. They actually went and got that reference and put it in the episode. And that's probably down to you reading what Plutarch's
Lives, you know, where you just go through that jaw dropping going, oh my God, there is so much food here for this character. We didn't really go to Shakespeare very much at all. Famously, we didn't go to Shakespeare. You know, the post moment after Caesar dies, a lot of people have complained, you know, where was Mark Antony's funeral speech? How are you going to follow or try and replicate after having looked at Friends, Romans, Countrymen? Why would you try to compete with the greatest writer of drama there has ever been? You're only ever to lose your battle every single time. Anyway, Bruno, genius, just a genius writer. And yeah, there are lots of stuff in there that we would bring to him that had never been seen before about these characters. I think that's what I'm trying to say. And there's so much more information in Plutarch's Lives, and it's Suetonius, and it's Cicero, all of these characters. It's just, you know, delicious.
I agree with you. There'd be no point in replicating Shakespeare. And I sort of thought it was deliberate that you were playing against Shakespeare at times, playing against people's expectations, because that's where they'll probably have seen these characters. And even if they haven't seen the plays, they'll know the Et tu, Brute line, which also was not there. I was very glad that it wasn't. None of that. We're not doing that. We're not doing your expectations. But I am wondering now whether the tongue-biting scene was inspired by Kevin's first meeting with Ray, with the toe man.
Toe Elliot. I mean, it's possible. I don't know. I mean, I don't know where Bruno came up with that idea of the tongue bite. I remember that scene with Menio. That's right, it was Menio. I just rewatched that scene tonight and I was like, oh my God, this is genius. But you know, I think what I loved about the whole show was Bruno. I remember he took me and Ray aside and he said, listen, these two characters are some of the only non-upper echelon characters that were ever mentioned in the ancient writings. You know, this Caesar mentioned Pullo and Varinus in this one paragraph. And remember, you used to talk about that? One paragraph, you'd say, there were these two soldiers in my legion who hated each other but loved each other and competed with each other but actually would die for each other. And they were called Titus Pullo and Lucius Varinus. And I think that is one of the things that really elevated the show, was this inclusion of these lowly men. All these other writings are all about the illustrious figures of history at that time. And I think that's what really helped to elevate.
It was through them and through their relationships often you saw the culture of Rome.
Yeah.
I always remember there was a lovely scene you did where you're talking to your wife. What was the character's name?
Niobe.
Niobe. And you're talking to her, but you're doing blessings and you're setting up an altar and doing things and talking to her over your shoulder. But that idea of that culture of the gods being so intrinsically understated and yet supporting all of everything that is going on. But I love the way that it was put into the vernacular of the dialogue in such a kind of subtle and yet muscular way often. Yeah. You know, and it really gave the show a kind of contextual religious depth that was never banged on about, you know, but it was just part of society like it is today.
Kevin, I imagine that you had a quite a different experience than to James with the development of your character and what your character did throughout the show, because you had such a lack of historical information about him. He was such an original creation. In some ways, that would have been very freeing.
I remember Bruno used to say things like that Polo and Varinas were kind of, in a strange way, the Forrest Gump of this show, that they would touch moments in history and the kind of butterfly effect of them being involved would make the levers fall in these massive historical
In a way that has happened with the things that you two have done.
Yeah, but mostly by accident.
Had fallen in that way, in some bizarre way.
And that was the genius of his writing. So we had this liberty, I think, Ray and I, to just kind of live these characters and be very, very human. And it was kind of, there was an upstairs downstairs model to this.
You say it was like Downton Abbey?
I mean, it was sort of
the Downton Abbey.
Not quite. I would say upstairs downstairs. We were the lower classes, kind of down in the mud, scrabbling around to try and stay alive, suddenly plucked out of obscurity by Mark Antony and by all these characters that we all know through history. Varinas actually rose up in this artificial way that really destroyed his life and destroyed his relationship with his wife, and it destroyed his relationship with his children. But at the same time, that destruction led into more the fact that he is connected to Mark Antony, and those things happened as we continue on in season two. So it was a really liberating experience to play those characters because we could just kind of have fun with them. You know, I imagine for you, you had all this weight. Everybody knows who Mark Antony was. We didn't have that pressure.
I don't think I felt that. I felt that we were finding a new Mark Antony. I felt that we were finding something that we'd never seen before.
Yeah.
I felt that there was a version of Mark Antony being shown for the very first time that was not this kind of tortured, troubled hero kind of figure of Shakespeare, but actually just something dirtier and vulgar and flash and silly sometimes, but also moving and lyrical and gentle. You're always looking for that, aren't you? Mm-hmm. Characters should be like diamonds that go, psh, psh, you know, and fire off different bevels of the diamond at any one time, so that you never quite know where you are with these people, but you sort of love them. But I love the ride that he gives. You know, it's all about the ride.
Mm-hmm. That certainly worked for me with your version of Mark Antony, that he is at times really despicable, but a bit like Polo. You know, does terrible things, but you're still on his side somehow. And your relationship with Caesar is a bit like Varinas and Polo. You're very different, but somehow you're friends. Somehow it works.
I think that Bruno did that on purpose. I'm really convinced that there was a kind of Shakespearean quality. That's exactly the kind of thing that Shakespeare would do, is have lower figures in between the scenes, replicating and mirroring the people of higher social status. You know, so you always get that juxtaposition about the way that they're always growing against each other. And how does Mark Antony behave in a way that, how does Bullo behave? You know, so you're juxtapositioning in your imagination all the time what characters would have done in a different situation.
And Varinas and Polo seem to almost change roles. Like Varinas, Kevin, your character kind of goes off the rails. And Polo, in a way, seems like Ray's character becomes more responsible.
Oh, yeah, completely. If you watch season two, he's completely undone by the death of Niobe, you know, and becomes this kind of almost Bryan Cranston-like, you know, Breaking Bad. He goes from being this virtuous...
Cannot be blinded, isn't he? Yeah. Right. And that's the only way he's going to behave. Those are the configurations.
Right, exactly. You know, the development of Lucius, Varinas, and Polo, I think, is a really interesting one, because Ray and I, in the first season, it's funny, I feel at liberty to talk about this now.
Interesting.
We did really... We honestly didn't get along in season one.
Interesting. You know, right, yeah.
Me and Ray would fight a lot. We were at each other's throats. We were, as actors, we liked each other, but it was something that infuriated us about each other. And I think it was, looking back on my...
I think it's probably a competition.
Yeah.
was competition. Who was the alpha?
Yeah. And it was looking back 15 years ago, and it's over 15 years ago now. It's really fascinating to go, you know, we had this kind of like battle of wills between ourselves. It's very caveman. What's brilliant is that you see that in season one. You see in season one this kind of competition and sort of hatred for one another that transforms into brotherly love. And I always remember on the rap party of season one, me and Ray, we look at each other and we've been at each other the whole season, just fucking, you know, just annoyed and mad at each other and fighting and all this stuff. And it was kind of very much mirroring what Bringing the Spoiler were doing in that season. And me and Ray looked at each other and he said, come here, me and you, we're in this big party. He said, let's go out. And we walked out onto the Senate steps while everybody else was inside the stage having a party.
Like you do.
And we sat there and he opened a bottle of tequila. And we started to drink and share this bottle of tequila. And he said to me, let's have it out right now. We've had all this beef with each other this whole season. Lovely. And he said, and I let
you all... see, you didn't do that.
No,
that's
no.
interesting, isn't it?
I let everything off my chest and I said everything, every kind of grievance I felt I had with him. He said every fucking grievance he had with me, right?
Right.
Good. And by the end of it, we were both in tears. And I remember we had this empty bottle of tequila at the end of it. And he said, let's throw this bottle into the center of the forum and let all of our grievances be gone. And I said, okay. And we both threw this bottle into the middle of the forum, smashed, and we hugged each other and we cried.
Magnificent. Great big
witty. And from that moment, honestly, from that moment on, we became like blood brothers. And then you could see that play out in season two.
Nice.
That we were suddenly just bonded and inseparable. I don't know whether it was the writing pushed us towards it, or whether it was just our own egos and vanity and our younger versions of ourselves. I don't know. I'll never know. Well, but that's the journey of what you saw on screen between those two characters. It was kind of playing out in real time, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
How was that not in the show? Did you watch the last episode of Rome today, did you say?
I watched the last three today.
He did.
Mark Antony and Varinus essentially replicate that scene in the last episode.
That's right. That's right. It's very much that same scene.
Yeah. We were, in fact, discussing that earlier because we were so drunk when we shot that scene.
You weren't meant to say that, James.
No, I know. I wasn't meant to say that. It was a long time ago. We wouldn't do that now. Times have changed. But I was also so saying how remarkable it was that actually we weren't kind of show-off drunk either. No, we didn't arrive on set going, we're drunk. We just kind of knew that we wanted to be in a place for that. It was the only scene of the day that we had when it was early in the morning that we were going to shoot it and the sun had just come up and we'd just been up all night and we just went straight to work. But we went to work in a quiet, drunk way. It was kind of respectful of everybody else, but we were absolutely smashed. And I think you can clearly see that on the screen.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very good acting. It's not acting at all. Just
the curtain has been torn asunder. We've seen the reality. We thought you were just doing it really, really well. We've asked everybody that we've spoken to this, but how did you feel when you knew that Rome was coming to an end a little sooner than was originally intended?
Bitterly disappointed, I have to say, because I felt like we were on something. And the fact that we were cancelled, I think, before we started the second season.
Yeah, that's right.
So we knew the second season was the last of the season, but we also knew what the potential was.
Yeah.
And the potential was we would go to the Battle of Philippi at the end of the second season. That would be the end of that, Brutus dying. And then we would go and do between Rome and Egypt for the whole of the third season.
That's right.
Because I suppose when you take on Mark Antony, the one big thing you're thinking about is Cleopatra.
Right.
You know, at some point, that cataclysmic collision of two such powerful planets smashing into each other of such incredible power, a godlike power. They really believed they were Isis and Osiris, the Egyptian gods by that point. They go out fishing, Plutarch's Lives, you know about this. They go out fishing and Antony always made sure there were divers putting massive fish on his line.
No.
Also, when they went out, everybody knew it was them, but everybody was told to ignore them. So they'd be out pretending, thinking they were getting away, with having a nice time out in the city in Alexandria. And everybody's going, don't say anything, don't say anything. It's them. They're right over there. It's Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt. You know, I mean, that's what it was like. But everybody pretending otherwise. And he had divers put massive fish. I'd say he could pull out these fish in front of her and she'd go, oh, actually, your fish is so big. Well, that's what he thought he would get out of it. But yeah, that's the truth. And so, you know, their power was mad and off the scale. So, like Shakespeare knew, because Shakespeare always concentrated on really powerful people, by and large, because the consequences of their demise are so great and affect so many people, you know. So the reverberations, the concrete block into the pond of society when they melt down is really, really cataclysmic. They went madly off the scale. I had read up so many things about them that I knew that we could fill easily another season with their antics.
That was the great tragedy of season two, was I still think it's a really strong season. We all knew that Bruno was forced by, you know, the decision of HBO to cancel the show, to truncate what he had already, in his genius brain, had crafted six seasons more of these stories that would really live on and be, as you say, a full two seasons in Egypt. And we had suddenly three episodes. And that was the real, that was heartbreaking. I remember that feeling of going, okay, we're all going to do our absolute 100% best, but the potential that we could have had was heartbreaking.
Yeah, because you feel like every time you do a scene, you're cutting into another year of huge events that we're not covering or referencing, or, you know, which are big chunks of a character's background. You need all that. So you feel like you're just jump cutting into the big scenes.
Yeah, so the Battle of Actium was reduced just to you two in a boat. Yeah.
In a car park at Cinecittà with a whole bunch of Italian Greeks.
When they go, like,
Bouncing you up and down.
The Italians, just one thing I just have to talk about quickly, about the fact that I am a massive Italophile. I try and go to Italy once a year. I love them. When we arrived there, they were very used to Cinecittà dubbing everything.
That's right.
And so, you know, it didn't really matter. If you were talking English, it didn't matter because it was going to get dubbed into Italian. Yeah. And they didn't really clock the fact that, no, this was the language. This is what we are doing it in. So you would hear them backstage, just behind the flats, just next to you, talking every single day. All you hear is them talking in the morning about what they were going to eat for lunch.
That's right.
They'd have little stoves,
didn't
they?
That's right.
They didn't like going to the canteen. They'd make pasta, big hulking guys making pasta and frying up things and making stuff. Where did you get the meat? Where did you get the meat? Why did you go there? Why did you go to that macelleria when you could have gone to this macelleria? It's crazy. You shouldn't have done that. They gave us bad meat last week. You know, all you can hear. And then one day, the phone rings. And I go, oh, God, that's mortifying. It's a bit, the first day of season two. This is our HBO producers are around the monitor. 14, I remember counting them. And they're all watching. And some guy's phone goes off. And you go, oh, that's mortifying. It's me, Caesar, chatting. That's mortifying. I can hear him. He's going for his pocket. I can hear it. It's getting louder. It's come out of his pocket. He's trying to find the off button. And then you hear, sì, pronto, mamma. Took the fucking call. Like, me to take, loud. And then the next day, it's obviously he was shut up by somebody going, what the fuck are you doing? The next day, on the call sheet, it said, in Italian, it said, please do not be offended if you're asked to be quiet during a take. Please do not be offended. Why? Hilarious. Loved them.
I love the Italian crew. They were amazing. But the HBO execs didn't know what to do with it, did they?
No.
What is happening?
It was very alien to a lot of the execs of HBO. I think they're finding it quite difficult. It's a very different culture.
Yeah.
You know, Italian filmmaking and the way they make it is a very different thing. I mean, the biggest ego on the entire set was, he'd hate me for not remembering.
Marco Pontecorvo?
No, I'm not
Marco Pontecorvo.
No, that's Hairstyles. Adriano.
Was it Adriano? He did.
He's a massive Oscar winner.
He did Brad Pitt's hair in Troy.
Yeah,
Brad,
there you go.
That was his big.
Yeah, but he was, without a shout, the biggest ego on the set.
Oh, yeah,
without a lap.
The hairstylist.
The hairstylist.
Yeah.
Italy must have been particularly dear to Ray's heart because he met his partner when he was shooting.
Yeah, of course it was, you know, and he fell in love with this girl. It was astonishing. I spoke to her a couple of weeks ago or a week ago, and better suited than many to have dealt with what she's recently dealt with, you know. Ray, for any woman, was a handful. He's a big stallion, you know, and he needs to run off. You know, he needs to run off. He was not the easiest horse in the stable to look after.
But Better could handle him. Better, you know, she could. But
she could fucking handle him. Right? Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Perfect.
Perfect. I remember that I was there the night they met. Basically, she was his landlady. She owned the apartment that he'd rented. We were sat playing guitars and drinking red wine like we always did, talking about the characters and the work we were going to do. And there was some problem with the boiler or something. And he said, oh, I'm trying to get my landlady down here to sort this boiler out. And in walks Betta. And she's smoking a cigarette. She goes, she has this deep voice like this. I was literally in the room, the only other person in the room,
really,
when they met. And he was pointing at the boiler, saying, the boiler, this boiler. And she was like, did, did, oh, I'm done. I could see the chemistry like that. You only see the chemistry happen. And sure enough, and you know,
nice.
So it's a beautiful, she's an amazing woman, and they were perfect, perfect match for each other.
Yeah, exactly. They really were.
But they met over a broken boiler.
Over a broken boiler. Yeah.
In Italy, for that to be romantic.
Yeah, who'd have thought, really, who'd have thought that love could spark over a broken boiler?
It sounds like the show has had quite an impact on everyone's lives that we've talked to, really. And everyone that we've talked to while doing this podcast has had quite a lot of love and affection for the show, not just for it as a product, but also what it's done for them later on in their lives as well. And you called it a salad show, I think, James, or something like that.
It's an English expression, you know, your salad days. You know, often there are times when you just come out of university and, you know, things are okay, but you're struggling, but it's fun and everything seems rosy. You know, it was a very rosy time. I had this driver called Luigi, and Luigi, he smoked so much. I'm worried for Luigi. I can't imagine he's still alive. Because he was always dead driving me. Luigi would pick me up in the morning, every morning, and take me into the studio at like 6 a.m. You go through Rome. Rome is beautiful at 6 o'clock in the morning. Oh. Pink, soft pink light over the Colosseum and the Forum.
Going across the cobbled streets.
And you're going to another version of it, and you're going to stand there. You're not fucking Anthony.
Yeah.
Rock on. And you'd stop, and I would save the day. And the first time we'd stop off at a little cafe by the Colosseum, and we'd have a cappuccino, and that'd be his first thing he'd done, the first thing that passed his lips. So that's kind of his milky breakfast. And then we stop off, and we'd drive to Cinecittà, and there's a little bar opposite Cinecittà, and we'd stop there, and we'd now have an espresso with a grappa. It's like 6:30 a.m. We'd do an espresso and a grappa. And then you'd be ready. You really would. I'd arrive, boom, get that fucking grass on me now. I'm alive and ready to go. Fantastic. So memories like that. Luigi, famously, he was a really good double for Al Pacino.
Was he?
I like, really good. Like, wow.
I remember him.
Yeah,
I remember
Luigi. Him. And he had been Pacino's double on The Godfather, Part 3. And there was a scene at the end where he had to walk away from camera and Pacino couldn't make it. And so they asked Luigi to do it, and Pacino called him and said, Luigi. So now, when you do the scene tomorrow, I might just put some stones in your shoes. Mr. Pacino, what are you talking about, stones in my shoes? No, put some stones in your shoes, okay? Just in one shoe, just put a few stones in your shoes. And sure enough, when you watch The Godfather Part 3 and you see Pacino walking away, you can see this man looking at it like, fuck, Jesus Christ. And he is Luigi with a stone or two in his right shoe, making him sort of move like an old man.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I've seen it. Believe me, it's amazing to watch. So you know that story.
Oh, my God. I love it. I mean, that's like shooting at Cinecittà Studios. We drive to Cinecittà. Cinecittà has so much history, cinematic history, epic cinematic history.
Yeah.
You could feel it coming out of every building.
Yeah, the guy who made my cuirass, the leather bit that goes on top here, his dad made Richard Burton's, and his dad had made Marlon Brando's. Wow. Yeah, there was a direct line to my armour between those actors. I mean, that's...
Yeah. Ugh. You can't repeat that. You can't... You can't put a value on that.
No. Yeah, they just know exactly what they're doing. They're brilliant, amazing crews. Hundreds of them, though, weren't there?
Yeah, hundreds.
Hundreds. Never seen such an overpopulated set in my entire life. People, you just go, I've never seen that person working.
Yeah. I remember after every take, almost every take, because, like, you know, we do a take, it'd be a close-up. Let's say the shot was a close-up on me during the speech. Mm-hmm. What can go wrong? It's a close-up on me.
Yeah, right.
I'm saying a few words, and then you'll cut. I think, okay. All the Italian crew after every take, and I'm talking every take, we'd be like, Vaffanculo, and he's like yelling at each other, and it was just how it was done, and it was just this madness. There was this kind of energetic madness to it. It created a fertile ground for such creativity and passion.
Yeah. Right. Because even the staid English actors who, you know, are pretty much right the way across the board, basically all of those actors had come out of classical theatre one way or another.
Yeah.
They come out of drama schools, they come out of classical theatre, they knew what they were doing. And quite often the American directors would go, fucking great, man, that was fucking awesome. You know, we just got to fuck it up a bit, right? Screw it around and more mistakes. You can't make no fucking mistakes. You know, that's the truth. Sometimes it can be too well
too ordered. Polished.
Too polished.
I imagine scenes like that, and in particular, you know, scenes like the triumph that you had in Rome, especially in the last episode, given what you've told us about the Italian crews, must have been very interesting with the amount of extras involved in those kind of shots.
Yeah, of course, I know, of course. Yeah, I remember somebody died.
I'll never forget
one of the senators.
It was one of the, it was during the opening of season two where the senators, just after Caesar had been assassinated, were asked to run down the Senate steps and run out of the Senate. And there was those scenes of these older senators running fast. And we were shooting that in the middle of August, very, very hot in Rome. And I remember Tim Van Patten was directing.
Yes.
And it was tragic. One of our background writers, who was an elderly gentleman, who had been with us all since the beginning, he just had some kind of heart event on the third or fourth take, and he dropped dead right there.
Third or fourth take,
yeah.
I have to say.
That's right.
That's not right.
No.
With gentlemen of that age.
Yeah, and I remember we went home, everybody went home. It was really, I forgot about it.
I mean, that's the thing. When you work on a show like that, like anybody will tell you on long-running shows, you know, people die, people are born.
Mm.
Relationships start, marriages start. That's I met my wife when I was in Rome. I would definitely not have the three kids now that I got if I hadn't been for Rome.
Mm.
You know, so many things have happened to all of us because of Rome. But that's just the sliding doors theory, isn't it? You know, sure. The jobs that you end up doing.
Did you meet
Jess during Rome?
So are you going to tell us the story of how you met your wife, James?
I would love to tell you the story, but it would go on too long. masked ball, Blenheim Palace. She was wearing a cat mask, and I was wearing a devil's mask. Make that of what you will. But that's another story for another time.
And it's a brilliant story, however. It wasn't in Rome, but it was while you were making Rome.
Very warm.
Yes, it was when she was in Rome making a documentary about blah, blah, blah. That's when I re-met her again.
Can I ask then about the interaction between your two characters? Because you were very important to each other from the first season Verinus owing allegiance to Mark Antony almost for giving him a break and letting him back in the army. In a scene which I think, James, from memory, you were stark naked getting a washdown in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
All the way through to the assisted suicide and the death, with Verinus being the last person there standing with him who could wash him and dress him, the closeness of that relationship between the two characters. What was your perspective on that?
It was such a beautiful meal. I mean, I think a lot of what Bruno wrote in the whole show was a depiction of male camaraderie and true friendship and love, male love, which I think is a thing that not talked about much. Pullo and Verinus had it, but I think Verinus and Mark Antony had it on a very deep level. I mean, Mark Antony basically saved Arenas's life after the death of his wife. You know, he was non-functioning, not able to do anything, and Mark Antony walks into his apartment at the early parts of season two and pulls him up and uses the most loving...
He says, stand to fucking attention when I'm talking to you.
Correct. Mm. And just the best kind of tough love between men that can be given, you know? And I think the reciprocation of Varinus helping Mark Antony take his own life at the end was kind of Varinus's final deep thank you to him, if that makes sense. I think their friendship, it wasn't even a friendship.
It was kind of a weird, slightly bisexual, I'm convinced, slightly bisexual kind of thing where Mark Antony could see in Varinus, they have that fantastic scene, which one of my favourite scenes, where Mark Antony's wearing a dress, I mean, literally a dress. It's like pink, soft dress, and he comes in looking for Cleopatra, and he comes across him and Cesare. Is that one name? Caesar's boy.
Caesarion.
Playing ball with each other, and he has a chat with him, and he says, you and I, we have the same sickness, don't we?
That's right.
Which is depression, the sickness of addiction / depression.
Yeah.
And Mark Antony's mad at this point. He's like mad in his dress and his eyeliner, and you know, I'd shaved all the hair off my body. It's gone. It's on his pipe, and yet they have. And even within that thing of Varinus being, you know, quite a kind of NCO, a proper
stoic,
a stoic officer of this is the way you behave and this is the thing you do, which full. Control, you know, he managed to do that for two seasons, even though he went off the rails a couple of times. By and large, the conflict and the dichotomy between his sense of morality and his sense of total fucked upness was always a really interesting thing for you to mind, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so, but by and large, Mark Antony looks at him as the same one. He's the same one.
Yeah.
And from that, still deduces that he's actually, no, as sick as he is.
Well, basically the same.
The same thing. Doesn't really matter about the status thing. Yeah. It's like being at an AA meeting.
Yeah, that's a really good analogy.
Obviously.
But that's a perfect analogy. We have the same sickness.
They have the same
and
sickness,
I think they were very weirdly connected,
the
two of them. I just see it as this, I feel like a lot of men in the world spend a lot of their lives very alone. Mm. I think of the male experience back then, now, and will continue for generations, can be a very solitary experience. And when men can actually find some kind of connection,
some kind of common
that
ground,
goes beyond just talking about football and talking about the basic shit of life,
yeah.
It's a very profound thing. And I think that's what we managed to capture a little bit in that relationship, you know?
Yeah.
It is one of the interesting things about any TV or film production about Rome is that you end up having to talk about masculinity and kind of what it means in the current moment, I think. So it is a discussion of that. And we spoke to Coral, who played your daughter, Kevin, and she was talking about the scene where you physically attack her. She said that, you know, she was kind of prepared for kind of almost encouraging you to attack her more, and you were holding back because you were worried about hurting her. I mean, that's kind of one of the worst things Varinus does, and that is the kind of outer limit of his what we call toxic masculinity now, that he's such a paterfamilias, he has to have total control over them, and she's done something to betray him, so she deserves this. And it sort of brings him to the brink. And I wonder what you remember of that scene, because she remembers it as you kind of being more gentle than she was expecting.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, of course, we are method actors to a point, but like at the end of the day, all I cared about on that day was Cara was this young girl. She was maybe 17 at that time.
No, she was young.
And I was like,
you
I just
should look after her.
I just want to make sure she was all right.
Yeah, I'll make sure she's okay. Like, and if she is okay, fine. But if she isn't, I'm there.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm glad that was her experience, because that was my. I mean, obviously, I wanted to deliver the moments and mean the performance and make it seem to the audience like Verena
this was completely out of control.
There are so many ways of doing it as an actor. You know, when the camera's on you, you have a great deal of power about what, where you are in the frame and what you're doing and what you're doing to the other actor in order to get the feeling across the audience that that's what you're doing. Nobody actually has to be nasty.
No, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So anyway, I'm glad to hear that her experience was that I took care of her on that day.
It was that, and we had specifically asked her because our experience of it as an audience was that it was very violent. And we're like, you know, how was it for you? And she, that's what she told us, that in fact she could take more. And I get maybe that more having more experience as an actor, Kevin, that because she was so young, she didn't realize that it could appear very violent without actually having to be so.
Right, correct. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you very much for letting us just rabbit on.
Yeah. No,
it's
no,
good to
it was quite emotional to talk about it. You know?
Yeah,
it really is. It really
I'm not even sure if your sound quality is going to be good enough for you to put this out. So
it is absolutely terrible, but I'm hardly going to edit it.
There you go. Your pleasure doing this, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been lovely. It's been lovely for, I don't know, I reached out to you, didn't I? And said, somebody sent me this link to your chat with Ray, and it made me cry when I heard you talk to Ray about and hear him talk and the reminiscences that he had, and he just died, I think, that week. And it just, it really just opened the floodgates for me, and I know it did for you. Mm. So it's really nice to sort of like close the circle in this way. Mm. So thank you. Really, truly, thank you, because your podcast with him really was very healing to listen to in that week
really
that he passed.
Yeah, because he's just so full of life.
Yeah.
So it made it really hard to imagine that wasn't going to happen anymore. But he was so fucking full of life.
Yeah.
And if that's it, if that's all you got, that's all you got, isn't it?
That's right.
And if people go, I'd like to be remembered like that.
That's right.
Jimmy, he was so full of life.
That's right. And you are, James.
Oh,
I love you, mate.
I love you too.
It's such a pleasure to talk to you, especially about Ray. And we have such happy memories of interviewing him and of seeing you all in the show.
Yeah.
All right. Well, and have a good day now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Take care.
Okay. Have a great night, guys.
Much. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the final episode of Raising Standards, an occasional rewatch podcast in which we take a fond look at HBO's Rome with Rhiannon Evans and Matt Smith. Our thanks to our very special guests for this episode, James Purefoy and Kevin McKidd. And also, as this is the last episode, I'd like to give a genuine thanks to all of you listeners out there who have supported us for the past few years and gently encouraged us to keep bringing out new episodes. I'd also like to thank all the actors, directors, and writers who stopped by to share their memories of what is genuinely an amazing television series. If you enjoy this podcast, make sure you check out our others, Emperors of Rome and When in Rome. You can find us on social media on the Emperors of Rome Facebook page, and we are also on What Is Left of Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Raising Standards, and so for one last time, I'm Matt Smith. You've been genuinely fantastic, and thanks for listening.